The House Capital Investment Committee is called to order. Members, we don't have a quorum, and so we'll move straight to the agenda. Today, we have the Office of the State Auditor here before us to present on stress tests. And so with that, welcome, Auditor. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, members of the committee, and thank you for all of the, I want to take a special moment to thank the staff who helped us get set up, and I think you're very lucky to be served by the tech people that you have here. So with that, as you're seeing on here, and you also have a handout, I believe, from us about our infrastructure stress transparency tool. Now, this was a, tool provides maps and reports on size, capacity, location, age, finances, and users of city and special district water and sewer systems that provide, it's a lot on this. Just realize that sentence is quite a deal. So this tool basically brings a number of data sets together and puts them to maps to visualize them. Now, the project grew out of the University of Minnesota's 2015 Smart Cities and Infrastructure Convergence Colloquium. State Auditor Otto at the time and a team of collaborators worked to create this series of interactive maps. And so for the first time, we've got it visualized our civil infrastructure. Now, this tool was launched in 2016. We've also had a recent update. And this is the group that works on it, Uspatial at the University of Minnesota. Infrastructure data experts from Department of Health, Pollution Control Agency, Public Facilities, our office, the Minnesota Infrastructure Alliance, you may have known them as Minnesota 2050, and the initial funding came from a serendipity grant from the University of Minnesota, but since then the funding comes from a Bush, there were some Bush Foundation grants, but right now it is primarily funded through our office in our operating budget. So, let's get into the data. Here we have OSA senior researcher John Jernberg, who's been here through the entire life of this tool, and I think he does a great job of explaining that. So now if you want to play along, you know that that handout that we gave you has a code on there, so feel free to hop in, or you can go to the office of the, type in Minnesota State Auditor, go in there, go to tools, pop it down, and you'll be able to get here and play along with your own area. And I'm sure, John, if we have any requests for which districts we want to use, so I think you picked some from our people, too. So, Chair John Jernberg would be available to go next.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hey. Thank you, Chairman Lee. Thank you, Chairman Lee and members, and thank you, State Auditor Blaha. My name is John Jernberg, and I've been working on this project since 2015, and it's been exciting for us that work with a lot of data because it has been soloed. We've had Department of Health data, we've had Minnesota Pollution Control Agency data, but we weren't able to merge the sets without people having to do a lot of the work themselves. So this tool brings it all together, and I think it's a very exciting piece, and it will be becoming more robust over the next few years as we add the lead service lines to these maps, and so we can see where there are still lead service lines in the state. The data that's in this map is presented both visually through maps and also through dashboards. And cities or special districts can be selected either using the map or typing in the box here the name or the special district that you're looking for. There are a series of 12 maps, and to find the maps, you click on, under the maps tab, you click on what you want to look at: water, sewer enterprises, asset management systems, things like this. So the first map we're looking at is predominant collection sewer system age. And so we can...
Can I hop in one quick?
Go ahead, Auditor.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chair Lee. For those of you who have just come in, I'm just going to hold this up for a little while he's talking, because you can play along if you go to this. I get 8 free of these with a trial I'm on. I'm very excited about my QR code. So thank you. I just want to help people hop in and hop on if they want to play along.
So
thank you,
far,
Chair.
Julie, got it.
Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Lee. For every map that you choose, to the right of it, you will see a legend. And so in this case, on this map, circles represent cities, diamonds represent special districts. And the colors associated will tell you if it's green, the predominant sewer age is less than 30 years old. If it's yellow, 30 to 50%. If it's red, it's greater than 50%. That means that the there are more miles of that particular age. So it's the predominant collection sewer system age. The size of the dot or the diamond indicates the number of miles of sewer system. So the larger the dot, the more that you, the more miles of sewer system that there is. And if I type in a name, I'm just going to try Roseville just to start this out, and we'll comparisons. I click on the Roseville dot, the dashboard comes up, and we have a dashboard for every city and all the special districts that handle this type of, you know, if it's a water district or if it's a sewer district, they will show up here. The top part always shows demographic information, population, household, and median household income. And the median household income is an important feature, as we'll see later on, because the charges per household for using 5,000 gallons a month of water should be less than 1.4% of the median household income. So that we'll show that a little bit later. Going down a little bit more, as we look at this ring chart, if I hold the cursor over the color, I can see that there's 82.65 miles or 50% of the sewer system that is less than 30 years old. So yellow would be the amount between 30 and 50, red greater than 50 years old. So you can kind of see the percent there. As I scroll down a little bit further, in this case, if sometimes a city may have their own wastewater treatment facility. In this case, because it's a metro city, it's operated by the Met Council's Environmental Services, and so that it lists that. And then we look at wastewater charges. So residents are typically charged in the city of Roseville $71 per 5,000 gallons per month. And that represents 1.14% of the median household income. And this is how we judge that. Another, if you want more information on what you're seeing, each piece of the dashboard has a little circle with an eye in it. And if I select that, that gives you additional information of where the information came from, the age of the data, things like that. So in this case, it comes from the WIND survey, and that is from the Wastewater Infrastructure Needs Survey, and it's done for 2 years at a time, and it's from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So it provides additional information on each piece of this dashboard. Another piece of data that we have is, and this comes from our office, it's the Enterprise Fund data, and it shows operating income without depreciation included, and then net income. And with these maps, if I hold the cursor over the dots, I can get the actual dollar amounts that these represent. And you want to make sure that you're operating above zero, and the red down below just shows that when these lines drop below that, you are not collecting enough revenues to cover your costs. To go down a little bit further, if an entity had any clean water projects on the, well, it's clean water project priority list. So if they have put in an application for funding for a project related to clean water, it would show up here. The next piece of data is drinking water usage and storage capacity. It kind of tells you how much water you can produce in a day and what the storage capacity is within the towers or underground and things like that. So go down a little bit further, we can see what the water assets are. Is it wells? Is it standpipes, treatment plants? And then for storage, is it elevated ground, hydro-pneumatic, or other types? Water Enterprise Fund income, same as for sewer. We want to see things operating above the red line, or at least trending up. If they're not, generally that means they're going to have to raise the amount that they're charging for their for water. And then, again, drinking water PPL, drinking water project priority list, if they have applied for grants or loans, it would show up here. And the final piece of data is asset management. And so the Minnesota 2050, that's what it was called, they survey all of the cities and special districts in the state to find out if they have an asset management system in place, if they do, the name of it, and then what part of it, is it map, is it just data, and kind of what things that are measured. So that's kind of what the dashboard looks like. Charlie, are there any questions?
Members, any questions? Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation, and good to see you, Ms. Blaha. So you mentioned water usage. Do you have an average for example, a family of four? How much water would they use?
Mr. Jernberg.
Chair Lee, Representative. We do not have that as a data point in this piece. I think that that the 5,000 gallons is probably what the average is per household in the state. One thing, I'm gonna clear out this filter. One of the other things, we have a number of demographic filters, and so I can do it by household income, population. Let's see here. Yeah, that is not a filter that I have.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Representative. And this is a great opportunity for us to hear what your questions are. And I know you have a busy committee meeting, but if you ever have a specific question like this, or you start digging in here and say, I wish we had this run, please call us. This just makes our day when we hear about an interesting data set that you're looking at, and it can help us, again, move things ahead. John Jernberg himself will be happy to talk with you, and sometimes we can run data for you, a specific poll that you're looking for.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I just put in context the 5,000. Where'd that come from? I mean, mm-hmm. Why that amount?
Mr. Jernberg.
Chair Lee, Representative, that was determined by the data expert from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's a figure they use. I'm not sure where it comes from.
Okay.
Originally, that's not my...
That's all you need to say. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
So before we move on to more members' questions, I do want to acknowledge and welcome our guests from Spring Grove Elementary who are here visiting us. Thank you for coming by to visit us.
Elementary? Is that elementary?
That is elementary, yes.
Wait, what is it? Yeah, I think they're going real tall out there.
Secondary. Well, sir, I apologize. That was the information that was given to us, and so I think the Historical Society needs to update their information they're providing to us, and I think the Historical Society is here, too. So
I was looking forward to seeing their basketball team.
They're going to get kicked out of school for not shaving.
So right now, why don't we go to Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Auditor Blah. You know, the logical question that comes up is if we have all of this information at our fingertips, if all Minnesotans have this at their fingertips, why is the Public Facilities Authority using only median household income across the seven-county metro area when they're looking at implementing both federal dollars and state dollars for affordability.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to take that as a rhetorical question. Our job is to give you the data so you can make a decision based on facts, but I think it's a fair question.
All right. Members, any additional questions? I see none. Thank you, Auditor, in your office for coming by today. So next up on the agenda, we have the Minnesota Historical Society. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Vince Whitworth. I serve as Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society.
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society.
Mr. Chair, Lee Erdahl, members of the committee, before we get into our presentation, David was reminding me that I said, we didn't provide that information. And then he said, yeah, we did, because that would have been a school tour. So my apologies to the chair and to Spring Hill High School, I think it is. But we are Spring Grove.
Spring Grove.
I'm going to stop while I'm in a hole and not dig any deeper. But anyway, we are delighted to be here this afternoon and appreciate the opportunity to provide a brief summary of our mission and strategic priorities, and then quickly move into a review of our 2024 capital budget requests. Would like to thank you and all the committee members for visiting the History Center last fall. That was an important visit. We were thrilled to be able to take you behind the scenes and break bread together and hear from a few other requesters, but it's always an honor to have you at the History Center or at any of our historic sites around Minnesota. In the interest of time, I will not spend too much time on our strategic priorities. All that information is in your handout, but it does give you a sense of who we are, what we do, and where we're trying to go. As we think about our mission statement, there are two words that I think are perhaps most important. The word all. We serve all Minnesotans, and we are working hard every day to try to do a better and better job at that. In a previous hearing, we were also talking about the importance of curiosity, and we are trying to get Minnesotans to be curious about their story and the stories of their neighbors. And so you will see that has an awful lot to do with informing where we're trying to go as we think about removing barriers to access, reimagining space, both physical and virtual space, sharing authority and expertise, and then obviously making sure that our efforts are sustained for future generations. As we look at the request, two of the three are going to look very familiar to you. As an organization that stewards 26 different historic sites across Minnesota, about 150 buildings, well over 100 of those, over 100 years old, asset preservation is always going to be near the top or at the top of our capital budget request. The third item there is a grant program that enables us to support local history projects through municipalities and that type of thing. But what I would like to do is just touch very briefly on the one in the middle. The second item there is for design work that focuses on what we are characterizing as the PATH project, the preservation and access to history. Succinctly, this really helps us focus on two things. One is to long-term provide secure storage for our collections. We are, in many respects, the keeper of Minnesota's material culture, and you have seen our collection storage in the facility. But the other piece of the PATH project is to make sure that we are staying in touch with the visitors and the Minnesotans that we serve and providing rich and meaningful and relevant and safe, frankly, visitor experiences. So collection stewardship and visitor experience are the two high-level themes of the PATH project. So we'll dig in a little bit further, and as we do so, I'll turn to David to talk about asset preservation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair, I know that you all are familiar from your capital budget visits with historic sites around the state, and we really, really appreciate the visits that you have made to those historic sites where you can see firsthand the unfortunate, in some cases, needs that are out there. As Kent mentioned, we're responsible for 150 buildings around the state, half of which are over 100 years old, which requires some special care, sometimes specialized architectural work to make sure that those buildings are taken care of. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're using this diagram to try to demonstrate our system-wide needs for capital budget deferred maintenance. If you imagine this as a bucket of water, and the bucket of water drains off a little bit each year, if we don't keep up and that bucket of water goes dry, then we're in trouble. Then we have crumbling infrastructure. We can quantify this information, and we estimate that it takes about 4% each year to replenish this bucket. And that kind of makes sense. If you think a roof is going to last for 25 years, that's about 4% each year, to just make a really simplistic example. So if you think of that 4% that we need to keep up, the bar on the right is 4%. That would be, for us, about $16 million. If you look at the historical average of asset preservation appropriations, they're significantly lower, in the under $5 million range. We received a significant appropriation in 2023. We appreciate that. That will help us to catch up, but we need to continue to catch up so that our infrastructure stays strong and safe for our visitors. This list of about a dozen individual projects is what comprises our 2024 asset preservation request of $13.6 million. Projects around the state at places like Fort Ridgely, Fort Snelling, Snake River Fur Post, and et cetera, et cetera. You can see the list. So individual projects that will be carried out by our project managers in that order, that is in priority order. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that you all have been interested in what did happen with the appropriation that was made in 2023. And this is a work plan for those projects. A little bit hard to read, but each line is an individual historic site project. Most of those projects are underway in design, and again, sometimes requiring specialized historical preservation architects to get the design moving forward. And we plan to have all of those projects underway and completed before the deadline for spending those projects. And I won't spend a lot of time on each one, but there's information in your packet. I know you all have been to a number of these locations before, the good, bad, the ugly, and always interesting to go and visit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll turn to the second priority in our capital budget request. And as I said, that is our PATH project, our Preservation and Access to History initiative, which is really major enhancements to our history facilities. And let me provide just a little bit of context. Many are surprised to know that the History Center is now more than 30 years old. And I'll remind this committee that we have welcomed millions of students, lifelong learners, and tourists from across the country, certainly across Minnesota, and really around the world. And we are very excited about the next 30 to 50 years of the History Center, not only to continue welcoming guests, but also to become more of a center of engagement for all Minnesotans as we talk about the alignment with our revised mission statement. A couple of things that were not present when that building was designed first and then built. Think about it from technology standpoint. That building was designed in the late 80s, opened in 1992. That's really pre-internet. And we have made some upgrades, but we were not able to do a comprehensive upgrade from a technological standpoint. Think about the issue of security. This building opened, obviously, pre-9/11. We have made some adjustments along the way, but as we think about the next 30 to 50 years of the History Center, we need to think comprehensively about security. And also, if you think about physical access, that building opened, as I recall, pre the Americans with Disability Act. And then finally, obviously it opened pre-pandemic, and we're all continuing to sort out what that work, recreation, and balance is, and what do workspaces look like in a post-pandemic environment. So huge issues for us to consider as we think about the next generations, the next generation of the life of the History Center. And so this is the logical time. We have been engaged in some master planning. We've engaged the Perkins and Will architects, have a presence here in the Twin Cities, and have deep experience and expertise with museums and cultural facilities across the country. Let me start with one of the priorities of the project, and that is collections care. We have an outdated building here in St. Paul at 1500 Mississippi that for decades has provided adequate storage and security for some archival collections and many of our three-dimensional collections that are in storage. It is time for us to retire that building. We are kind of using chewing gum and baling twine, if you will, to kind of keep that functioning. But we think it's logical now to make an investment not only in master planning, but the next phase would be design and then obviously construction in the next 4 to 6 to 8 years. So collections care, stewardship of Minnesota's material culture is high on our list with this PATH initiative. And the second is just visitor experience. And if you think of, I think there may be a few images that can help us think about the different ways we engage the public, and we also store collections at the History Center. We have small pieces of paper, we have vehicles and structures, and literally everything in between. And you see an example of literally back in the fall, you saw archives stacked to the ceiling in at least a two-story space. We have maximized that space, but we also have some unfinished space in the History Center that could be converted, and that is a part of the collections care process. And then we will likely need to build an off-site dedicated storage facility with the appropriate climate control and security controls as well. So if we just say, I'll say a few words just about the visitor experience as well, as we think about engaging people that are experiencing exhibitions, that are doing research, that are having educational kinds of experiences, both formal and informal, as well as just continuing to be a place of engagement as communities grapple with relevant issues and they need a historical perspective and historical context. Visitor experience needs are very different now than they were 30 plus years ago, and this project will enable us to address all of that. We're requesting $6.7 million in architectural design work in this request, and we are looking at both the work that would take place in the History Center as well as the design work that would take place as it relates to a standalone collections facility. But we feel like it'd be much more efficient for us to do that design work together rather than to break that up. So with that, I will hand off to David to round out our presentation as he talks about the third item in our capital budget request.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, number three in our request is the County and Local Historic Preservation Grants Program. This has been around for a number of years, and this grants program offers cities and counties an opportunity to preserve their most significant historic structures. It's a matching competitive grants program, and often cities or counties will use this for county courthouses, libraries, city halls, their most important historic structures, and this helps them to take care of historic preservation in the most appropriate way. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, that's the end of our formal presentation. We're happy to answer any questions. We really appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee and discuss our capital budget request.
Thank you both. First up, we have Representative Franzen.
Happy Wednesday. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Say to either one of you, Mr. Whitworth or Mr. Kelleher, I did go over the governor's bonding proposal, but for the life of me, I cannot remember off the top of my head how much he had requested. Could you remind me in the body?
Director Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, the governor's recommendation was for $5.5 million for historic sites asset preservation and $1 million for county and local historic preservation grants.
Representative Franson.
So $1.1 million for county and local, and you said how much for the...
Mr. Chair, one even for grants and 5.5 for historic sites asset preservation.
Representative Franson.
Oh, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Director, just for the young people behind us, could you tell them what collections are? It's not like you didn't pay your bill and are collecting. Just perhaps. That's okay? Thank you.
Chief Executive.
Chair Lee and Representative Scraba, thank you so much. No, we are not talking about collecting in a financial setting. The collections that we're talking about are those items that help us preserve and tell Minnesota's stories. This, as I said, could range from a small piece of paper, a historic document, all the way to structures. Some of you have probably been to Split Rock Lighthouse. That is a large artifact, if you will, in our collections. And so it really runs the gamut. But in many respects, we are the keepers of Minnesota's material culture as expressed through collections. Thank you, Representative Scraba.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you.
Members, any additional questions? I see none. Thank you both for coming before us today.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 3870. Representative Olson.
This should be an easy yes.
Welcome, Representative, and welcome, Director Kerr. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3870 only needs to come to this committee because of one little section at the back, Subdivision 4. What this bill talks about is a new way in which the state can deal with assets, including the military, so state armories, things that the state possesses, and how we can go about interacting and working with cities and local governments in order to potentially get rid of or build new armories in the future. So the last section is the only portion that applies to the Capital Investment Committee.
So before you go, Director Kerr, I do want to move House File 3870 to get it before the committee with a recommendation that be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Director Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'm Don Kerr. The bill in its form actually applies to the authorities of the Adjutant General. The particular provision that was added at the request of Minnesota Management and Budget was to protect the state's interests in cases where we do take funds from this committee or bond proceeds to do renovations to facilities to ensure that we weren't renovating facilities and then selling them and keeping the money in the account. That provision is there to ensure that buildings that had been improved with bond proceeds would follow the statutory process for recovering the service on those bond debts into MMB. And so that is the provision that's in the bill that relates to the agency, or to this committee, excuse me.
Thank you, Director Kurt. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Olson. Just so that I understand, are you saying that the state of Minnesota should take care of property that it owns?
Representative Olson.
I would say that if the state owns it, it's a responsibility to either take care of it or dispense with it as the state determines.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Members, any additional questions? Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Olson.
Thank you so much for putting this in front of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Olson. The bill is laid over. So, members, before I move on to my bills and have Chair Zhang take the gavel, I do want to move the minutes for March 18th. Any discussions? Hearing none, Representative Scraba moves the minutes for March 18th. Thank you, Representative Scraba. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted.
I'll have to pass this, so you're going to have to kill me.
Welcome to committee, Chair Lee. Identify yourself for record and proceed.
Which bill, Mr. Chair?
I believe we are on House File 3584.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House File 3584, as you know, when we travel throughout the state, you know, many communities are telling us that they have reached their capacity on taking on more debt, and so that's why they're asking the state to help support them. And so this bill would just add on a requirement for them to provide their debt capacity to MMB when they go through the MMB process for submitting their capital projects.
Discussion? Do you have any testifiers, Mr. Chair? Our members of the audience want to testify? I have Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I am not going to go into a detailed discussion of this today. Happy to do that at a later time when it's, if the committee desires that. Just want to point out a couple of things on behalf of the cities in Minnesota. They spend an awful lot of time figuring out how they're going to manage the infrastructure they are required to have. So that includes everything, the water plant, the wastewater plant, the streets, all of the other public amenities that they try and make available for their citizens. And they do that through a capital investment plan, and they do it on an ongoing basis. There are some communities small enough that that is not a regular part of what they plan for, because only every 30 or 40 years does a big project come up that they need to do. So they don't spend as much time on that because there isn't a plan to do. This interrupts exactly in the middle of that and how cities can get the financing they need. And I think to just summarize our concerns with the language the way it is right now as concisely as possible, if you have enough money under this plan to put aside the cost of the facility for 20 years on a regular basis, you can then ask the state to get free money for the first time. But if you cannot afford to do that on your own, you can't get the money at all. Because the requirement of this is that you have an investment account that you put together and put that money aside. So we don't think it works.
We are on House File 3584, and what you're discussing is a different bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I am very sorry I got waved up. I thought it was for the bill that I had signed up on. The debt capacity issue, Mr. Chair, I can be very brief. We think that that is a legitimate piece of data that is readily available from cities in their annual financial reports. Our only concern is that how it gets used. Just because a city could have up to 3% of its property values in debt does not mean that that's a good move for that community. It could actually be that that would cause a huge property tax increase trying to meet the payments on that debt load, and it would also leave you with no capacity for other emergency needs that you might need to finance in your community. So we're fine with that number being part of the regular public record. That makes total sense. But we do want to warn that that does not mean that a city can afford to go to that maximum amount just because it exists. Thank you, and I'm very sorry for not knowing which bill we were on.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Further discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, closing statement, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, I guess, to close it off. And I appreciate the league bringing that up. And I think the example that I use is that, you know, for MMB, you know, we have three debt capacity guidelines that we have to follow when we think about, you know, putting and structuring our bonding bill. And oftentimes, I think that, you know, when Chair Murphy was here, when I've been chair for the last few biennium, I have always wanted us to go up to the maximum amount that we could allow, you know, 3.2, 2.5 in previous years, but we never get up to that amount. And so I think that, you know, we should, you know, also have the same expectation that just because they have the local communities have the capacity to do so, that they are being good stewards too. And so we just need to know this information so that when we're putting our budgets together, we actually have all the information that's needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee. I believe we have another bill of yours. It's House File 3582, and I believe you have a DE amendment called a DE3 for reference only. To your bill, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So the DE3 amendment is just changing some items after receiving some technical feedback from MMB, and, you know, just trying to address some of the concerns that I have heard so far from people who are concerned with the bill. And so what we did in the DE3, we clarified that the commissioner means the commissioner administration, who will have more expertise to accomplishing what we're trying to do with the bill. And then we're just adding the definition of preservation as an allowable use for the replacement account. And so the purpose of House File 3582 is for us to really look at this, you know, when we have projects in front of us that are asking for our support. You know, as we have seen on the tours, communities have put in infrastructures over 30, 40 years ago, and now it's to the point where they need to be replaced. And I think that, you know, for us to be good stewards of the public's dollars, you know, we should have a plan in place and require a plan in place so that there are, you know, dollars going towards this replacement, so that they're, you know, local communities are not just coming to the state of Minnesota to fund the same projects over and over, where, you know, over the last few weeks we have heard from all of our state agencies where our state assets are growing. And, you know, just to remind the, you know, the committee, the request from state and local this year, you know, is over $7.6 billion. And for us to really address that, we do need some help from our local counterparts. And so this bill will require the establishment of a replacement account that could be used for major rehabilitation, expansion, or replacement of the project. And then the DE amendment did add for work that will be allowed for it to include any asset preservation work. And then admin will be in charge of figuring out the minimum deposits that are required to be put into the account. And then we also have the state auditor giving them the authority to look at these local government's account as an audit. And then we provide exceptions to projects that receive funding through the WIF program because they are currently doing this already. And then we have a penalty that, you know, if they don't set aside this fee, then you'll it'll be collected through MMB into the general fund. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions and public testimony if there are more.
Any public testimony? Welcome back, Mr. Johnson. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and this is the bill I started talking about last time before I realized we weren't on it. So just very briefly to remind you, now that you have the language in front of you, Mr. Chair and members, this is the bill that would require that a reimbursement account be established in order for a project to be funded by the state through a grant. That means you have to have the financial ability and the cash flow to be putting money into that account on a regular basis, or you can't get a grant to do the project. And that just does not work. It makes it so only cities that already could have financed the project on their own would be eligible to get the grant money up front to do the work. So, Mr. Chair, we would happily continue to work with the chair. We do understand the need to find ways to watch the state's money and to make sure that cities are prudent in how they are using it, but we don't think that this approach will work with where money is needed and why it is needed. And I won't go into the details on that right now, Mr. Chair, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, real quick.
Representative Lee.
So just to correct the record, this is not a reimbursement account and this is a replacement account, and that this is not precluding them from getting funding from the state. This is a requirement for grantees that receive a direct appropriation or grant from money through some of the programs that we have. And so this is not a requirement on the front end. This is that if you are awarded a grant, then you have to establish this replacement account.
Gotcha. Leader, though.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Chair Lee. I want to thank you for bringing this forward. Not really. Well, yes. Thank you for bringing this forward for informational purposes. I think it's a a good discussion to have. And certainly there, through further discussion, maybe there's some ways to address some of this, but I just want to tell you that, as a general sense, members of my caucus don't like to combine policy bills with the main bill, with the bonding bill. And so, you know, we're, we appreciate the informational discussion, and, you know, there may be some things we can talk about in more detail later, but it, and again, in a general sense, we like to keep policy separate from the bonding bill.
Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl. I really appreciate that. And, you know, I think that we're going to have ongoing conversation on how we structure our bills and whatnot. And I believe that these policy discussions should be part of those conversations, too. Thank you for that.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would echo Leader Erdahl's statement on keeping policy and bonding separate is a very good idea. But on this particular DE, love the concept, because people need to have some buy-in, and, you know, some people come to the well more often than others, and, well, let's make sure that they can take care of their things. My question is, does this apply only to, like, political, like, government institutions, or would this apply also to private institutions that receive grant or something like that for a capital project?
Surely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is for grantees, and so this will include political subdivisions and nonprofits that do receive state funding too, and the only exception is our state agencies.
Follow up, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very good to hear. I think treating that equally across the board, and this is something that I think we should do, but I do think there's a lot of these communities and nonprofits that even if they were doing this couldn't, and I know you're aware of that. So putting some parameters around it, I think, so it doesn't hit these tiny communities that have, you know, just no money at all, but they need to drink clean water, that those communities can still afford to do this without having, well, they can still afford to do these things to keep their communities alive without having to do this. But I think many communities and nonprofits can afford to do this, and it would be a good policy going forward if we tighten it up a bit.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, thank you real quickly. Thank you, Representative West, for those comments. And, you know, like I said, I think this is something that we could continue to work on. Today, you know, we have heard some concerns, and I have asked for specific feedback on language and haven't received any. And I think to your point around those small communities, I would just remind the body and the committee that, you know, this is already a requirement under the WIF statute that if you receive funding through the WIF program that you set up this replacement account. And so this is not a new concept. We already have this in law right now. And last, when I chat with Director Friedman to see if there's any issues with any of our communities receiving WIF grants, making these payments, and today he said there has not been any issues with that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing this forward. You know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg question, so if we're the capital investment committee and we have capital investment policy, and we can't put that in a capital investment bill, how do you change capital investment policy? Except by putting it in the bill. So, you know, having traveled around the state, it's always kind of surprising to hear as a rationale, a reason for receiving dollars is, quote, that the state should pay for this, that the state should pay for this. That the state should pay for this. And, you know, we do come back to places over and over and over again. And so if the capacity isn't there ever to pay for it, I don't know. I think it's important that we do update policy. Otherwise, the status quo stays. And our state keeps changing, and needs keep changing. And if we don't change some of our basic policies, we're going to fall behind and keep doing what we've always been doing because that's what we've been doing. And they may be very poor investments if we have to keep back coming back over and over and over again.
Shirley.
No comments. I really appreciate that feedback.
I'm told that we have one more testifier, Scott Carlson.
Welcome to committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Scott Carlson, Mayor of North Mankato. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here. I'm actually excited to hear what I was hearing from Representative Lee. I know in the bonding committees, both Senate and House, we're down in North Mankato. We've been asking for our second phase, money for our second phase for bonding for a regional rec facility in North Mankato. I'm excited because when I hear what we're bringing before you right now, it's exactly what I told the committee members, any of you that were there. I said we would love to be supported with this bonding, but as a first-term mayor, never been in elected office before, it was disheartening to see how many people, when I testified last year, were asking for costs for roof repairs, refrigeration units for ice arenas, things like that. So I did say, and I do agree, I think that if we're going to invest, especially in things like we're asking for, quality of life, regional assets like that, that we should be accountable for saving along the way to do those replacement costs. So I just wanted to be able to come up and tell you that I appreciate this being brought forward. I am in big support of Mr. Lee and his bill. And so I hope that in some way or another that you're able to consider it, whether it's here or whether it's in policy next year.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Further discussion? Seeing none. Closing statement, Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for this brief discussion. I hope that we could continue to have this discussion. And like I always, you know, remind folks who are interested in this issue, I'm always open to have further discussions on how could we make this work for everybody. This is not a done deal to, you know, Representative West. For members, if you have any, you know, suggestions or thoughts, let me know and we could go from there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Our next hearing is on the 25th. On the agenda is the governor's bonding recommendations for the Department of Veteran Affairs, Military Affairs, and Veteran Affairs, and several GO bonding bills that will be heard on informational basis only. That said, this meeting is adjourned.